You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, December 19th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, if not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Jason Ben Levy with his book, Too Much Magic. Updates on D-17, Occupy, protests over the weekend. Kim Jong-il, we'll check in on his health. Not good, apparently. Mitt Romney's campaign, also not in particularly good health. Although better than Newt Gingrich's. Bradley Manning, day four for his Article 32 hearing, pretrial hearing. Some Medicare savings to report. And some interesting studies debunking some things. You're getting another feed of audio.
Yeah, I have no idea what that is. There's nothing else open on my computer, so I wonder where it's coming. I have no idea where that's coming from.
There's something else coming. Well, why don't you turn down that audio? Because, it's definitely coming through your computer. Yeah.
The only thing open on my computer right now is soundboard.
You got to shut off some of the other sounds or see if there's another program.
That's really weird.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is stunning. We will post this video on the Majority FM video. I don't even know what to make of it. I mean, there's not a lot I can tell you about Kim Jong-il. There's better places to go to get the implications of this, and perhaps this week we'll have somebody on to tell. As far as I can tell, this has been a long time coming, and so the succession of the next despotic leader of that nation has already been chosen. You know, years ago, as far as I know, a couple of years ago, at the blog Blood and Treasure, apparently the one interesting, there's a couple of just interesting notes. First of all, about apparently Kim Jong-il had a massive habit of drinking Hennessy, cognac. Hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in cognac the guy would drink. He wore lifts because he was very concerned about his height. The other interesting thing that I read, like I said, at Blood and Treasure blog, was that apparently because in North Korea, as opposed to, I guess, the Chinese, they did not fully jettison Confucianism in their sort of weird mix of ideology. And so Kim Jong-il followed his father, Kim Il-sung. And Kim Il-sung apparently was the great leader. Kim Jong-il, because in Confucianism you cannot sort of... you must be diminished relative to... in terms of lineage. So Kim Il-sung was the great leader. Kim Jong-il was known as dear leader. And I guess Kim Jong-un is going to be known as the successor leader. Sort of just, you know, I wish I could give you more insights into that. And I don't mean to, I really don't know how to react to this video. I really don't. It is one of the strangest things I've ever seen. North Koreans from North Korean state media, so take it for what it will, there's this amazing video of people just crying hysterically at the news of Kim Jong-il's demise. And the strangest thing is all these people are lined up in a square. They're looking at his statue. They're crying hysterically. One might, cynical among us might think that they're crying hysterically to prove that they're sad to those who are watching them. But the strangest thing about it is they're all sort of lined up and nobody's, some people are on the ground, banging the ground. How could he die? None of them are touching each other. It's the strange, listen to this video. This is in Pyongyang. Trying to sing, but they're overcome with grief, so they're crying. Young people are crying hysterically, but nobody's consoling each other. They're all crying hysterically. Nobody. No one's touching each other. You folks know that I wouldn't be. Oh wow, this guy's really upset. It really does look like they're auditioning for something, but it's so strange. No one's touching each other. They're just crying hysterically, folks. As I watch this, I think, particularly at this time of year, just what would happen to those of you who are not members of the Majority Report if the show was to end because of your lack of support. You would all be out there in front of your own iTunes or computers, looking at your iPod, just crying hysterically, and with no one there to comfort you.
Well, everyone would meet at the communal Sam Cedar bronze statue.
The Majority Report, there'd be a huge bronze MR somewhere in all of your town squares. But be that as it may, we will take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jason Ben Levy, author of Too Much Magic. A very fascinating take on the problems of our digital age and how, in many respects, Occupy Wall Street broke out of that, even though it relies so much on digital technology to spread the word. Later in the program, an update on the weekend in Occupy Wall Street. You're going to find this very hard to believe, but it wasn't just Santa who was arrested in attempting to occupy Duarte Square in downtown Manhattan. It wasn't just Santa Claus, as a wonderful way to diminish it. There was actually also a retired Episcopal bishop who was the first person to climb over that fence. Very hard to find that in the corporate media story being told here, but should be of very little surprise. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jason Ben Levy.
One day is fine and next is black. So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go?
Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double. So come on and let me know. This indecision's bugging me. If you don't want me, set me free. Exactly whom I'm supposed to be. Don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on and let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow?
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, Jason Ben-Levy. He is a author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Technology. And you can get more information on him at his site, jasonbenlevy.com. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Now, long-time listener.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. Now, Jason, tell me, let's start first with your background. You've been involved in the digital media for years.
Right. I'm one of those kids who was meant to be a science kid during the 60s and during the space age, and pretty much a contemporary of Jobs and Bill Gates. And, you know, back when we started, computers were big, hard things to use. And then kind of hippie science came along and computers became things that the rest of us could use. And we got to be able to do creative things with it, like starting your own radio show or publishing your own book or, you know, all the great things that we were able to do with digital technology.
And, but now you perceive that it's, there's an element of this that is problematic. I mean, you write that, the same, aspects about digital life that we appreciate are also problematic.
Right. One of the problems is, well, you know, again, when we started and we had our own individual computers, we were pretty well empowered to do things ourselves. And we like the idea of the internet being the thing that connects us all together. But it kind of changed the nature of both Silicon Valley and digital life when we started being able to connect things together. You know, when we think about most technologies, there's like a dark side and there's a positive side. And we always get sold the positive side or the technology first. If you think about plastics, what a miracle they were. And now they're, you know, filling our oceans with crap we can't get rid of, or with, so many different technologies this happens. With digital technology, we've managed to connect everyone together. But the problem is, the problem we always have, which is the people in control of us, in control of it, giving us the positive side of the story, are usually making a lot of money telling us that positive side of the story. And they usually neglect to tell us what the downsides are. When it comes to digital technology, our downside is that we've put very few people who are less than 1% in charge of all of this. That is, that we can't do our radio shows and our doing our various social network stuff without one or two companies holding it all together.
Now, what is exactly? What is problematic about that? What is problematic about that? I mean, you know, when we say like, what is the, be more explicit as to like, you know, what companies are you talking about and exactly what is the concern? Because I know that your critique is broader than the idea of privacy. What is problematic about those having that control there? It's driving the instruments in a wrong direction or what?
It's a combination of two things. It's a sociological thing in driving the instruments in the wrong direction, making us extremely dependent on them to the point that people in their 20s often cannot manage to do things without the technology. So they're becoming very reliant on it, and that leaves them vulnerable to manipulation in terms of depending upon that resource. That is, it's very hard for people when we look at Facebook, which is a great utility, it's really a data collection service. It's not, you know, we're not the customers, we're the product. And there's a lot of data collection that happens about us. But also it changes the way we behave with each other. It changes the way we occupy physical space. We no longer have the same kind of intimate connection in physical spaces. So, like, Sam, go to any cafe in New York, and you'll see two people sitting across from each other, both with their laptops open. And if you went to a cafe 15 years ago, people would be talking to each other.
Yeah, so it's twofold. I mean, I have to say, like, I have mixed feelings about some of your critique. But let's start with the dependency, because I do think the dependency thing is something that does really, you know, it does scare me a little bit. Because, and in fact, you know, I found my dad's house, you know, a series of the old encyclopedias and world books. And he was going to chuck them, and I was like, you know what? I'm gonna take these and just store them for my daughter in the event that, like, we don't have electricity in 25 years, and she all of a sudden becomes, you know, the sort of the Sarah Connors, because she's the only one with the books. I do think that's somewhat problematic, but if I hear what you're saying too, that part of the problem is that while this technology was to sort of create, make us all independent and more self-sufficient, in some ways that is an illusion, because our self-sufficiency is ultimately tied into one or two key operators.
That's correct. And so if you think about, you know, now we're having the net neutrality argument. And when you realize that when the internet started, there were multiple ISPs, there were multiple companies that you could go to get yourself connected to the net, and they were all independent, and it was something you had some sort of choice in. Now in most cities, people are down to one company to connect them to the internet. And those companies have their own political agenda. It's not really an odd coincidence that Comcast, as an example, would want to own NBC, which is a major news outlet. And Comcast has a political agenda. And if, and say, you know, where it starts coming into play is that if Comcast decides the Sam Seder Majority Report is something that they really don't want people finding, it's pretty easy for them to go and hide it.
That's right. I mean, it used to be when it was dial-up, I guess we had literally hundreds of different ways in which you would connect to the internet. I mean, it was all the same way, but different providers of that entry point. And
right,
now,
or actually...
Go ahead.
Yes. Now, you know, the way to approach this would be to really have a true public utility, which is to have, you know, a bandwidth basically as a public utility, just like we have highways, and just let people connect with their own individual local companies of choice. So that way they weren't subject to having a company like AT&T or Verizon, which basically was plugged the NSA into the switches and gave them full access, and then those companies received complete immunity for whatever they did.
So part of your critique is the consolidation of and our sort of the lack of reliance that we have on a couple of entities for access to this information that we've become so reliant upon. And then the other critique is sort of the way in which it is affecting socialization.
Absolutely. And that they're tightly linked. That is, that the more dependent we are on these resources, the more money the people who own those resources make. And the less able we are to do things ourselves, again, it drives us back to that same thing. That we're more dependent on them and spending our money with them. And again, when you look at the venture capitalist and their ties into companies like Goldman's, and even how the first dot-com bubble was really the bubble before the real estate bubble with a lot of the same players, we get the same kind of tizzy effect happening, that we foam people up about the excitement of the new technology. And in fact, a lot of it really is exciting, but the agenda beyond that is somewhat more nefarious.
That being just simply profit.
That being a problem, right. And digital tools, you know, we have an ability to do a lot of reality distortion with digital tools. When we think about how same tools that we're using to watch movies that with special effects are starting to find their way into the news, and there's really nothing stopping the news from becoming a good deal of falsehood, where we can no longer believe the pictures that we see.
And you wrote a piece in Common Dreams where you said you hold the view that, contrary to being a product of social media, and I'm not sure if that's necessarily, and that may be the conventional narrative that, you know, that is, it's a function of social media in some way.
Right.
But you hold the view that the Occupy movement results from the shortcomings and dissatisfaction of digital culture. Explain what you mean there.
Sure. So, you know, for the last, you know, decade or less, we've all been blogging and we've all been communicating with each other, and we're all in our own rooms. And certainly on the progressive side, we've been pretty vocal among each other. But then we found the Tea Partiers, who were kind of a faux group. Once they got out in front of the cameras in D.C., they started garnishing a lot of attention. Once they started showing up in meetings and disrupting meetings, people paid attention. And we may have all been commenting to each other about it on blogs. And again, I'm a pretty active blogger and engage in a lot of this activity. But no one was paying attention to us except us. It was effective for, you know, helping to raise money for Barack Obama. But again, once Barack Obama became president, he started listening to people like us and started listening more to the normal D.C. beltway. And so what happened with Occupy, people rediscovered the power of physical presence. And even calling it Occupy is important. People showed up. And when people showed up and didn't go away, which had not been the norm in any progressive demonstrations, people started paying attention. And we completely shifted the political spectrum, or at least the perceived political spectrum in the country because of that.
But do you think that the Occupy movement was actually a function of the shortcomings of media, or do you think that there's just a online media, or do you think that it's more of there's an increased sophistication of the role of social media and of online activities with a generation that has grown up with it? I mean, you know, the conventional wisdom when blogging became really sort of on the scene in the early 2000s was that this was just a bunch of that it was young people, but in fact it was actually sort of people closer to my age and older who were sort of first embraced this medium. And I think to a certain extent these were people who not necessarily that found it to be an end in and of itself, but, you know, it was a technology that people had to change the way that they viewed this stuff. I mean, one of the biggest things that blogs had as a hurdle was a sort of conventional notion of legitimacy. And the idea that, you know, look, you're a blogger. Who are you? You don't have an editor. You don't have an institution behind you. And now that's sort of that's not an issue. Nobody you don't hear people complaining that, you know, why are you following these people on Twitter? They have no editor or whatnot. I mean, people sort of now accept that there is something that is self-correcting and self-editing of social media. And there are less sort of like of these sort of more mundane issues that are dealt with, and that people understand now that it can be how it can be used as a tool. I mean, because it seems to me, it's not that Occupy is not a reaction to social media. It is in some ways the integration of it as something that, you know, we're no longer looking under the hood. We're just using it.
Well, yes, we're using it, but also we're extending it, and we're actually going someplace, which before we were kind of all in driver's training and doing the driver simulation of democracy. And when we, and again, it was great for amongst ourselves, but we weren't reaching the rest of the country. We weren't reaching the rest of the world. It really takes that kind of physical presence to draw both the TV cameras and the general population to pay attention to you. And just look at what the political spectrum was before people showed up on the streets and where it is now. And again, we had been doing the social networking part for on blogging for years. And it's great. It's a great tool. It's a, you know, I totally agree that it's essential to that digital democracy is really essential in terms of having a common ground for all of us to be able to speak to each other and to be legitimate. But we also have problems with digital media that is false. We have problems with a lot of disinformation coming out. And having a hard time verifying information.
So, to the extent that you see some of these things as problematic, what are the solutions? How do we guard against these? Because is there much that we can do about the fact that we have, you know, just simply a handful of corporations that essentially control or have the ability to control our access to this information, and therefore everything that we rely upon for that information?
Well, yeah, I think that a lot of it really comes to being, if we're going to start using technology, that we want to disintermediate a lot of the people and the companies that have been responsible for this. That if you think about the idea of Mozilla and the Safari, not the Safari browser, but the Firefox browser, it's not one company doing it. It is a company doing it, but it's not a for-profit company. There's all the smart people, you know, all collaborating on this project, and it becomes something that everybody can use. There's no need for people to go and collect any data off of that. It would be great if Facebook followed the same model, that if it was an open model, it would act as a confederation. Just like you use email right now, you pick any email client you want to use, and you can send an email to someone, rather than having to go through, say, AOL, which becomes the filter and the data collection service for all of that. So what I'd like to see is I like the technology. I want to see the business models around it change and move over to being really what I'd call a public option on most of this stuff, which would go and remove those companies from being part of the process. Similarly, I'd like to see the companies, the ISPs, like Verizon and AT&T, be pulled off of controlling access in every city, because of the physical connection, most cities only have one way of connecting. So I'd like to see the rules change about ownership on that, and people having options from picking more than one company.
And so, the latter being something that would obviously have to happen through regulation. I mean, how do you explain that? I mean, it's sort of surprising that there isn't a more of like an open source type of challenge to Facebook in some way, or is it simply that because Facebook is so easy, or has there been, and they just haven't been successful enough for me to know about them?
There actually is one that's called Diaspora, strangely enough, which really is an open and confederated model. It's still been very much in early stages, but the idea is that you own your own information. That it doesn't run on centralized servers, it runs on distributed servers, so that way there's not one point where all this data is collected. And then there's no arbitrators, there's no one saying that this is what you can do and can't do, and it becomes much more an open model, like we like about email and web browsers and that sort of approach. So it would be great to see social moving over from that. But right now, Facebook looks pretty ominous in terms of its intent, because if you think about the timeline feature, you know, do you really want that? Do you really want that much exposure? Think about kids and how much stuff they can expose, right, and how long and how persistent that information will be. You should be able to control what people see and what people are able to accumulate.
Jason Ben Levy, the book is Too Much Magic. You can go to jasonbenlevy.com to get more information. Thanks so much for joining us. Interesting stuff. Appreciate your perspective on this.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, some news of the day, of our era. Remember, later in the program, you can call in at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. Or our Skype handle
Majority Live. I don't go on Facebook. I mean, Majority Report does. And I it's too much for me. Can't do it. Grandpa's got to just sit back in his chair. He's counting the daisies growing.
You're on Twitter.
Twitter I love. Although it's not as fun for me anymore because Andrew Breitbart blocked me.
You got to find a new Breitbart for yourself.
I know. What a big baby. All right. We got to take a break. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. This weekend, D17 on Saturday at about 1 p.m. in downtown New York, as we were informed would take place by people we had spoken to last week. Hundreds of protesters approached Duarte Square. Duarte Square is down on Canal and 6th, if I'm not mistaken. 6th Avenue. And it is essentially an empty cement lot surrounded by chain link fences attached to the Trinity Church. Apparently, the Trinity Church is the third largest real estate holder in New York City. Understand that. That is a massive amount of real estate holdings. I can only imagine what the market capitalization is for something like that. Do you have a number, Matt? Do you know?
I'm looking right now.
It's got to be over $250. I would say considerably more than a couple hundred dollars. Certainly more than a year's worth of Majority Report membership. And there have been literally tens, 20s, there have been so many calls by clergy for the Trinity Church to allow for the occupation there. Now, I want to play this clip. This is put out by Occupy Wall Street. It features a woman who is a spokesperson for, presumably the media team, one of the media team members, explaining what was going on with D17. And she sums this up. It's very interesting, the connection between Trinity and Wall Street and the perspective as to why there's doing. Now, of course, to the extent that the corporate media covered this, which was sort of shockingly uncovered, although it did report that Santa Claus got arrested by the cops. There's been an attempt by the right to pursue this meme of, like, how could the occupiers go into this empty parking lot, essentially, for a church that helped people on 9/11. I literally got that in my Twitter feed. It wasn't from Rudy Giuliani. I should also make that clear. Sort of stunning how... You know, I can only imagine the people on 9/11 were hoping, you know, well, if we die, at least we haven't died in vain. Some right-wing douchebag will be able to cite us in their argument against income equality in the future, 10 years from now. But listen to this video or the audio from this video. We have posted the video on majority.fm for a clearer understanding of the perspective on why Occupy this space.
We are down in Duarte Square, which is a public area in lower Manhattan, lower western Manhattan, and we're having a huge party. And we're having a huge party to celebrate our three-month anniversary and the International Day of Tenting. Members of the New York City faith community reached out to us and said, you know, we know that you've been working with Trinity Church, a long-standing historic church institution and a billion-dollar real estate corporation. And we thought that because they have this beautiful abandoned plot of land right here that they can't build on right now, we thought that there was a chance that they would allow us to work with them and work with the community to create a place where free speech and right to assemble really thrives in Lower Manhattan. Power is consolidated in the hands of a few. And we talk about Trinity Church, and they've been our allies, absolutely, but the people calling the shots right now are the vestry. And the people who are sitting in the vestry and have that position are people who work on Wall Street. And I'm not saying those are bad people. They're probably amazing people who've done incredible things for the community. But I'm saying that power in this city and in this world is concentrated on Wall Street. And I know we've come a mile away from Wall Street, but this is Wall Street still. All over the place, it's controlled by Wall Street. The foreclosed homes out in East New York, those are controlled by these banks. It's all connected, and that's why our message seems diffuse, but it's really very clear. It's about consolidation of power, and it's about the 99% rising up and lobbying, essentially, to control our country. So, I mean, the same way that we're chanting here, we are the 99%, that's what Collective Voice allows us to do. Raise our voices louder than they could be individually, and collective voice gives rise to collective action. But to have that collective voice, we need a space to raise that voice. We will never change.
So, Trinity's Church's real estate holdings. Apparently, in 1912, the New York Times reported them as $75 million in 1912. Real estate prices in New York have gone up slightly over the past 100 years, and their holdings are now reportedly worth over $10 billion.
That makes them the richest church in the world.
That makes them the richest church in the world. Now, it's pretty stunning. And apparently, as the first person over the fence, I don't know if he was the first person officially arrested, was retired Episcopal Bishop George Packard. And there was an interview done with him. We can't play it because the audio is not very good. But as he was in the paddy wagon being driven away, or the whatever it was that the cops, the big bus that the cops used to haul away protesters, he made it quite clear that he felt that while Trinity Church leadership were sympathetic with Occupy Wall Street, he believed the reason why they were not allowing the occupiers to stay there was essentially for public relations problems that they thought they would have that would hurt their real estate business. Now, there are a couple different issues involved here. I'm not a member of the Episcopal Church. Is that what Trinity is, Episcopalian?
Yes.
I'm not a member of the Episcopal Church. I don't, you know, so leaving aside the idea that your religious affiliation should be something that controls that much wealth, I'm not sure exactly, you know, you can't take it with you, right? I mean, I don't know what happens with the Episcopal Church, what the idea is. I don't understand why any religious institutions, you know, sort of amass those type of fortunes. But they all seem to do it in one form or another. But that issue aside, the fact is that you cannot simply say just because they're a religious institution that we should ignore the fact that they control $10 billion worth of real estate in New York City, the third largest holder of real estate, and that shouldn't be pointed out. I mean, it's just one more thing that the Occupy movement is showing. When you have half of the population in this country
living below poverty or precariously close to poverty. When you have one out of five children in poverty, the idea that a religious or institution is controlling that much wealth is pretty stunning. I mean, I think you could probably do the same thing for some of the educational institutions in this city. The universities. And remember that $10 billion tax is tax-free. Their property is not taxed because they're a religious institution. Am I accurate in saying that? I believe that's the case. So it's fascinating. And it's even more fascinating that the corporate media has not reported on who was arrested there, except for Santa Claus. Santa Claus.
Another interesting fact, New York Stock Exchange is on Trinity Church's land.
Right. They lease it to the New York Stock Exchange. I think Jeff told us that last week. So, in Raleigh, North Carolina, six occupiers were arrested Saturday afternoon. I think some of those were part of Wacupy. Radio Ned informs us. Two were arrested in Portland. And again, you know, I think... as it gets colder, as winter wears on, as the Iowa campaign heats up, people pay less attention. Though in Iowa, apparently, the Occupy Iowa has now occupied, at least outside, I don't believe inside the Obama campaign headquarters in Iowa. So more to report there, but now we will go to the better half of the program. In the better half of the program, I will inform you of two really interesting myths that have been debunked. One is about unemployment insurance and what the unemployed do when they receive unemployment insurance. Here's a hint. It does not make them less likely to look for work. In fact, it's just the opposite. There's also data out that shows that despite the fact that we are now drilling in this country for more oil, it does not affect the price of gas or energy in this country. And despite the fact that we are importing slightly less, remember, our imports from the Middle East are quite small relative to how much we import. Most of it comes from Canada and Mexico. It also doesn't seem to be impacting our foreign policy in any way. You should also know about our refining capacities. All of these myths will be debunked in the better half of the program. Also, an update on the tax deal. It looks like this is going to be the second or third or fourth year in a row, third year in a row, I think, that Congress will be in session. And not just pro forma so that President Obama can't make any recess appointment session, but up until the day before Christmas, which I got to say sort of makes me smile, makes my job a little bit easier because there's still news. Austerity failing in Europe. Brief update on the Manning hearing from last week. The Affordable Care Act. It's helping some people already. Is it the solution I want to see? No, but we should report on the good that it's already doing. All that and more in the better half of the program. Folks, don't forget you can support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm, giving a one-time donation if you want, which people have done, and very sweetly, I should say. You can buy crap through our Amazon link, also on majority.fm. Buy Just Coffee from justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Folks, if you listen to the free podcast, please go right now and take our survey. It'll take you literally 30 seconds. It'll be in the top post on the blog at majority.fm. It will help us greatly.
See you in the better half of the program right almost now.